Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1 with Miriam O'Callaghan.
My guests this morning are a mother and her daughter who have a lot to look forward to in 2013. Amy Huberman is an award-winning actress who became well known to Irish audiences through The Clinic on RTE television. She's also a best-selling author whose second novel, I Wished For You, was published this autumn. She's married to Irish rugby legend Brian O'Driscoll and they're expecting their first child in the spring. Her mother, Sandra, is originally from Wexford. Amy is the middle child and only daughter of her three children. You're both very welcome.
Thank you.
Okay, Sandra, so what was she like? First of all, what was she like as a baby?
Well, as a baby, she was very squished when she was born, right? she didn't unfold for a while.
Tell Miriam who you said I looked like when I was born.
I can't remember.
Dawson.
No, it wasn't Les Dawson. It was somebody else that had a crease at the top of his nose. But anyway, she unfolded beautifully, I might say. Right?
Very beautifully.
Oh,
but she had her crying time, as some babies do. And she cried every night from the 6 o'clock news to the 9 o'clock news.
Colic.
No. Strangely enough. That was just her time of
It was
asserting.
From being called Les Dawson, I think. That's what I was upset about.
She was
about.
Just, you know, asserting herself. But it was always between the two newses on the television. So you never got to see the news for a while. But other than that, when she grew into a little toddler, she was a delight. She had a bigger brother who minded her like as if his life depended on it, which was lovely because they were quite close in age.
And what's his name, the older brother?
Mark. And Mark is an actor also. And then because they were quite close in age, I took a little bit of a gap. And then I had my third child, another boy, Paul, about 4 years later.
And since Amy herself is with child, did you have a good pregnancy with Amy?
Yes, I did. I had morning sickness on my three pregnancies, but with Amy it wasn't. I chewed a lot of licorice-flavoured chewing gum.
Really?
And that got me out of trouble. Don't ask me why. And I had quite an easy delivery, which was a change from
You're
the
welcome.
First time round.
So she was easy, really.
She was easy. She was.
And how's your pregnancy going?
Really great. I've been very lucky. I struggled a little bit at the beginning. I think most people do. I was getting headaches and, you know, I was tired, but I had still a lot of work to do. But I kind of said to myself early on that half it was going to be a state of mind and I was going to be positive and not give out. And if anyone heard me giving out, I was in serious trouble. So it's been good. I've been lucky that I've been feeling good.
And how many weeks are you now?
What are we at? Near just 7 months, yeah. Okay.
So you're nearly there.
Nearly there, which is exciting and frightening. All of the one go.
Is he or she awake right now as I speak to you? Like, is he kicking? I used to love that feeling.
No, not at the moment, but he or she does move around an awful lot. Never quiet for long. Probably like his or her mum.
Will this be your first grandchild?
Yes, it will be my first grandchild. And it is very exciting. Neither of the boys are in the type of relationships that are likely to produce children at the moment. So I'm depending on Amy
to keep going.
Yeah,
exactly.
Keep going.
Yeah. They say actually it's a very nice relationship, people say, when you have a grandchild because you're slightly more relaxed. And
I think so. I think certainly my mum, I would have regarded her as quite strict on me. And I was always astonished at how easygoing she was with my children. She absolutely adored the three of them. And she was terrific at sort of, you know, unravelling situations that I got into a knot over. She'd say, oh, no, we'll try it this way and blah, blah, blah. She was definitely a much more relaxed granny than she was as a mum.
And was your mum strict or not, Amy, as she sits beside you?
She's definitely the disciplinarian of the household. But I mean, strict. I don't think it was beyond reason. If Dad ever had a chat with you, that was the final straw. That was like the big moral high ground talk at the end of the bed. We'd come in and go, you know, very disappointed. But no, from day to day stuff, it was Mum you had to wrangle around. You had a well disciplined household, didn't you?
I did. I believed in routine. I think children absolutely thrive on routine, and they weren't spoiled in the sense that homework always had to be done. Television certainly was there, but I mean, I didn't agree with this business of watching television at breakfast and stuff before school. And, you know, I didn't think I was that strict.
It's really lovely when you do have routine and rules in your house like that and you're not spoilt as children. You do have that sense of excitement about things, and you remember them so clearly, like about just say, for example, like Christmas presents or birthday presents, because you weren't overindulged too much. Yeah. So those things became so exciting, or that you could watch cartoons on a Saturday morning. It's lovely to have that sense of excitement about things, which I think, you know, if kids are overindulged or if they're spoiled, I think you lose that so easily and you don't have that special feeling about certain things. Yeah. So thank you.
Okay, so it wasn't so bad after all.
And funny enough, it'll be interesting now when you become a mother if you will be like your own mum.
Well, Brian always says to me that he feels like he'll have to be the disciplinarian, I'll be too much of a soft touch. But no, I think you will. I mean, I think, and if it's for the greater good, I think you have to, you know, remember that with all things, it's, you know, the easier in the short term is going to be a headache in the long term. And you want your kids to be decent, nice people who aren't going to, you know, take everything for granted and be little horrors. Yeah. Yeah.
I think it was Churchill that said that greatness comes from discipline. So,
yeah, absolutely. But definitely.
She really liked Churchill in the house.
But I suppose Amy is known, Sandra, for lots of things, but acting, being a style icon, being a writer. What stage or what age was she when you noticed any of those gifts?
Funnily enough, Amy was the one who was always the artist in the family rather than the writer. When she was very small, her nursery school teacher said to me immediately, she's an artist. And when she was at school in Loretto, I mean, the headmistress assumed, well, Amy will do art. The writing really didn't come until later on. No, again, getting back to my eldest boy, he was the one who put everything down in words, whereas Amy was always doing something. She was always making something. She was always productive. She didn't actually spend a lot of time watching television as a child. It was always making something. And as long as she had loads of coloured paper and sticky things and scissors and all that kind of thing and paints and stuff, she was happy as Larry and could, you know, keep herself amused all day long.
And acting?
You kind of fell into acting
just
almost.
Followed Mark, really.
Absolutely. Mark, again, we keep talking about him like as if I don't have a third son who's a wonderful chap as well. But Mark was very, very quiet when he was about 11 or 12. And I thought, you know, maybe an acting class might help him out. And he went to Betty Ann Norton and it was just as easy to send them both. So Amy went along with him. As I say, Paul being the few years behind, you know, it took him a while to catch up. And then there was an acting school in Cabinteely for a while, local lady.
In the community school.
But it wasn't really until she did the musical with CBC and Loretto that they did West Side Story one year. And Amy was anybody's. I don't know if you know the thing, but she was absolutely. She stole the show.
Asked off.
No, and how old would you be then?
She was wonderful.
That was fourth year in school, but it was the only non-singing part because I can't sing. So it was the only thing I could do.
But you did it extremely well. Yeah. And people still say to me, you know, God, I remember Amy as anybody's. I mean, she really it's like as if she found her own skin.
That's so nice. And did you think yourself at that moment in fourth year that maybe you could do acting?
Never, really, to be honest. Again, it was kind of a lot to do with Mark's influence. I never thought that acting was a viable career. And, you know, we were always encouraged to do what we wanted to do. But, you know, there had to be boundaries of that as well. And it was more, you know, go to university, which we both did and didn't study acting. But, you know, a lot of my friends then went to drama schools in England, which were hugely expensive. And that kind of, we weren't going to do that. That wasn't an option. And that, you know, they supported us enough, you know. I never thought there was another way. And it was kind of all happened a little bit by accident, by just doing amateur dramatics. So it was only really when I got my first job and on home ground that I was like, I actually am working at this. But again, it was, you know, Mark had gotten a big part in Band of Brothers and stuff. And I was like, that's great. But he'd been studying science in Trinity. So we both, I don't think, really set out to do it. But it kind of...
No, it was there. I suppose it was in their blood. I kind of thought, you know, it's important to have something to fall back on, was the way I put it.
Yeah.
Looking back on it now, I don't know how wise that was, but at the time I thought it was important for them to have something to come back on. But obviously the talent was there. See, talent comes out in different ways in different generations. And my husband was a designer. I had an uncle on my father's side who was in the Abbey. It was there, it was in the family. A first cousin of my husband's was the producer of the Morecambe and Wise show and the black and white minstrel show on BBC all his life. So, you know, it was there in the family.
That's so interesting.
It was there.
We were not a stage school family.
No.
There was no influence from mum and dad, you know, driving us there and going, get up there now and do an Irish jig. And, there was no kind of precocious element to it. They were just classes that we did along with other things.
Absolutely, exactly. I feel you have to leave childhood to children, or leave children have their childhood. I think there's an awful lot of disappointment with going to feshes at a very young age and stuff, and only one can win.
And
it's very hard then for the kids who don't win, who have tried their best, who are probably very good and maybe for whatever reason weren't so great on the day. So I didn't believe in that. I didn't believe in dragging the kids around the place too much when they were small.
And as you say, you didn't need to, because it outed in the end, and you didn't have
to try.
Which
is nice that you do find it yourself instead of, you know, being forced into it and then go, did I ever really want to do that?
Yeah.
You know,
and am I even any good at it?
Any good, exactly, exactly.
But you're being modest as well, Sandra, because you're a great singer.
Well, I don't know about a great singer, Miriam.
She is. She's
I've
fantastic.
Been told.
No, she is.
I discovered when I was about 12, one of the nuns in the Presentation College in Wexford, where I went to school originally, discovered I had a voice. One day this note came out from nowhere and thought, my goodness, she can hit an A or whatever. Anyway, I did musicals in Wexford, and then I got a scholarship to a school in Arklow that was very famous for its music. And Sister Agnes would literally get a voice out of a tin can. And whereas I was raised almost as an only child, because my two brothers were much older than I and my parents lived separately. So I was raised on my own with my mum. And whereas a lot of people find boarding school difficult, I absolutely thrived in it, because I had, all of a sudden, I was in a room with 40 girls sleeping at night, and
loads
we had great fun, absolute great crack. And the whole upstairs of Arklow was music rooms, so it was heaven for me, because I wasn't at all athletic or sporty, right? Amy got that for me. I think Amy played hockey in Loretto for about 3 weeks, and that was it.
Two.
It's okay. The child has Brian's genes for that.
Yes.
Go sort that out.
And the family needs them, I can tell you. But that was when I really started taking singing seriously, and did all the feshes at the different ages and that kind of thing, and started winning medals and stuff. And the last time I was on radio, actually, was in the RTE studios in Henry Street, singing on a programme that Pat Laid, who was a big name in radio at the time, did Children at the Microphone.
That's so sweet. So how old would you have
been,
Sandra?
I probably would have been about 16. And
did you sing?
Oh, I did. I sang, absolutely.
What did you sing?
I can't remember what I sang. Something from the Fesh Kiol that year anyway. And my biggest regret is that they choose certain people from the whole Fesh Kiol, and they do a Fesh Kiol concert each year, right? And in those days, it used to be in the RDS. Nowadays, it's in the concert hall. So my opportunity of singing in the concert hall was robbed from me.
And would you like, Sandra, to have tried and made a career out of singing? Was that something you thought about?
No. Again, as Amy was saying, in relation to the acting, I didn't see it as a viable, you know, career as such. And I didn't come from a background that I could kind of depend on my mum to keep me until I became successful or whatever. And then as well as that, I really, my biggest dream in my life, because I grew up more or less on my own, was to have a family and a husband and a house and a home. And that's what I really wanted more than anything else. And I was in different musical societies through the years. One particular one that I was in, the Sandymount Musical Society, we won the Ames Award, and then we won the Waterford Light Opera Festival Award. And because of that, because we were so good, we got a week in the Gaiety. And to be very honest with you, I was so tired after all of that I said, I can't deal with this. So I think a church choir is kind of more in my strength than the children were too important to me, as they are to working mums as well. But I didn't have the stamina for both. And Harold also travelled a lot, so I was at home alone with the kids Monday to Friday a lot. So I couldn't be off out dancing on stages.
Well, look, we'll get back to the marriage and Harold and stuff, but we're going to take the first piece of music, Sandra, which is a piece you love, which is The Laughing Song. Tell me about it and what it's from.
Well, it's from De Fledermaus, and we did it. It was done as a school production in Arklow, which is quite an unusual school production because it's quite operatic.
Yeah.
But that particular year, in sixth year, there happened to be a great pool of voices, and Sister Agnes thought, right, this is the year for De Fledermaus. They always brought in a professional producer as well because, you know, that was the standard of music in the school. So the laughing song is sung by Adele, which was the part that I played.
The laughing song there, your choice, Sandra.
Yes.
So tell me about your dad, Amy.
My dad, Harold, I call him Harry. I think I'm the only one who does. He's great. How long has he been in Ireland now?
40 years.
40 years. And you wouldn't think it because it's like he's just stepped off the boat from the East End of London. He's fantastic. Yeah, like he was a designer and had his own label for years designing women's coats.
So where did you meet him, this young girl from Wexford?
Well, this young girl from Wexford wasn't awfully good at her studies in third year and failed accountancy in the BCom final, which is possibly the most important subject, right? So had all sorts of bank loans and things and had to get a job. And I happened at the time to be a size 12. And Doreen needed what was called a house model. Nothing terribly glamorous about it at all. You showed the garments to the buyers, but you also worked in the factory as a garment was coming through. It was put on you half made in one thing and another. Anyway, Harold interviewed me for the job and I got it. And as I say, I still have it.
Yeah.
37 years later. But he was very different to anybody that I had known at college, and very, very artistic, an absolute genius at what he did, I felt anyway. Certainly fashions have changed now, but in my day you got dressed up on a Saturday night to go out and you put your coat on and the whole effect was ruined until you took your coat off again. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But Harold just had a knack with coats, that you put the coats on and they improved you.
Just gorgeous coats.
Yeah, just gorgeous coats. And he also, which was unusual at the time, cashmere coats tended to be navy black and camel. And he introduced beautiful colour into cashmere coats. So that's really where he made his name.
And he's Jewish.
He's
is
Jewish,
that correct?
Yeah.
Because it's such an unusual, it's a wonderful name, Huberman, isn't it?
We're the only ones here in the country.
We're the only ones in the country.
So was it an issue for you, how many years ago was that you met and married someone who was Jewish, or was it not an issue at all?
It was an issue. It was 40 years ago I met him. We got married 37 years ago, and only that I had a very close friend of Father Vincent Keaveney, who had been my chaplain at UCD, and he had done all the debating stuff and one thing and another. And at one stage I was a bit of a nerd, actually, Miriam, when I came up from the country first. I was on the Pioneer Total Absence Association in UCD, and so was Father Vincent.
No harm with that.
And we became very good friends, and I went turned to him for help because I won't say the rules had to be bent, but things had to be a little gentle with Harold. I didn't want him to bolt. So we had a Catholic ceremony without a mass, and all the prayers were through Almighty God, amen, rather than through Christ our Lord, amen, and one thing another. But at the very, very end of it, Father Keaveney said a prayer and said, through Christ our Lord, amen. And Harold and I just kind of looked at each other and said, well, it's too late now, we're married. But he was very good. And because of Father Keaveney's Christianity, basically, the children ended up Catholics. I think if Harold had come against a stone wall, which he didn't, he would have been a little bit more, I don't know what the word is I'm looking for, he wouldn't have been quite as easy about the kids being raised as Catholics.
Yeah. Father Keaveney saved the day, really.
Father Keaveney saved everything. The day, and he's gone to heaven now. He died quite young. He was a lovely man. And we have a funny system in the house. Harold obviously came to communions and confirmations because it was important to the children, but he found he couldn't go to christenings.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, he found he couldn't go to christenings, but what he did was, his contribution also always was, after a christening we had a Jewish meal.
I never knew that.
Did you not?
No. Well, it was very too young.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
And why is that? I suppose.
Because that's the essence of Christianity. Yeah. Like, it's accepting a child into Christianity. And he just found that. Now, he's not a a religious Jew, but he still found that hard to take. But we always came home to a lovely Jewish meal after the christening.
Well, that was kind of, I mean, even every Sunday, you know, we'd go to Mass and Dad used to go to the Bretzel Bakery and get bagels.
Great.
So we'd come home to that. So it was kind of on a smaller scale.
On a smaller scale, that
continued
was Sunday.
That. Yeah.
That's so interesting. Because I think having a Jewish parent is fascinating because it gives you, Amy, a whole cultural, historical background, doesn't it, as well?
Definitely. And it's one I feel quite strongly. You know, as Mum was saying, Dad isn't religious, but, you know, Judaism embraces a huge cultural aspect, which has definitely influenced our family in ways that you don't even consciously register, that can come out just in differences when you're talking to, you know, other families that they're, you know, that's just two Irish Catholic parents. But it is interesting, and because Dad is from London, his family are all over there, and I mean, they live a very Jewish way of life, so when we spend time with them, it's lovely to see that as well. You know, you can see how Dad grew up and what his references are. But it was always a really interesting thing. You know, I know that Dad has certainly come across elements of kind of racism at times here. But moreover, not, you know, it was always seen as something
interesting.
Yeah.
I always saw it as a positive, actually. I never saw it as a negative at all.
No.
And is it true you met Alfie, your uncle, and was it with him you went to Auschwitz?
Yes, we did go out together. It was actually my first cousin, Adam. He used to work with tours going out to Auschwitz. We decided on a Friday night, the Friday night dinner in the Jewish household. We all decided to go on the Monday.
So
as you do. He's like, have you ever been to Auschwitz? No, let's all go. So I'd called Dad. I just thought it'd be a lovely thing to do with him. So Dad came over. We all went on the Monday or the Tuesday. I can't remember. My uncle Alf, a few of my cousins, Peter and them, came with us. And it was an incredible journey. And it was an incredible journey to do with them. Because, you know, generation-wise, they all had very different experiences of, you know, their memory of, or, you know, their view of the Holocaust. I mean, my Uncle Alf is, how old is he? 89. So he, you know, was very close to. Exactly. And I remember talking to a rabbi. There was two rabbis that came over and they had this amazing ceremony of light around the gas chambers there. And it was snowing and it was, you know, everything that you visually see in the movies. And I was talking to him and I was like, you know, I'm not Jewish. I'm Catholic and my dad is Jewish. And he said, well, then you are, because you've got the blood and that means that you're a survivor. That was the first time I'd kind of thought about it in that way. He was like, you wouldn't be here if they hadn't left Poland. And, you know, you really see then your through line of where you started out years and years and years ago.
And where is your dad's family originally from? Is it Poland?
Yeah, Poland. I think the town they're from doesn't exist anymore.
No, it's a suburb now of Warsaw, I think. It was just obliterated.
And did all of his family manage to get to London, or did
no.
they?
No. No.
Tell me a bit about them.
Only some of them. Harold's father, I think, was about 13 when he came, or 11, around that age. And he always spoke, he had a funny accent. He was a lovely man, very gentle man. And he had a kind of a broken English East End accent that it was quite extraordinary. Some of his brothers and sisters would have come, and they always, like the Irish did going to America, they sent back money, you know, and from the time Hitler invaded Poland, they never got a letter again or never heard any more again. So the family was just wiped out.
But I mean, that is such a close family experience. I mean, it's barely a generation ago.
Well, that's the thing. When you think about this, it's not that long ago. So it does, you know, directly affect someone like Alf, who is that age. And then, you know, it does affect you because it is your lineage and it is your family. But if you haven't faced it and actually seen it, you're very far removed from it. So it was amazing. And you know, it was one of those things that was so surreal on the day that it took me a while to kind of calibrate what was going on and realizing how massive it was on a global scale, and then on quite a personal scale as well.
Did you find it upsetting?
It's strange when you don't know anybody personally affected. Yeah. It's a different. I felt very proud of my heritage, and it's upsetting on the day because, you know, you're looking at people's names in that room. I'll never forget, you know, with the suitcases. Yeah. when they all have to personalize them because they thought they were just going to labor camps and they, you know, needed to identify them when they were when they thought they were going to leave. I went home and watched the Pianist, and that film particularly, it is the build up to the Holocaust. It was, you know, all the families being rounded up, and it made it, you see the families suffering, you know, particularly. And yeah, you can in that way kind of actually see it in your head what they must have gone through.
And it's almost chance, Sandra, that one part of your husband's family got out and got to London.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Completely.
So random. Yeah.
I mean, Harold has a story about one of his first, well, the chap that was that worked in the BBC, Ernest Maxson, his father was 13 and his grandfather would have worked in an orchestra that played on a boat that went up and down the Volga. I don't know which river it was anyway, every Sunday. And there was word came that there was going to be trouble. And he brought the son with him this Sunday and let him slip overboard when he was near a bank. I mean, it's the story of films, it's the story of novels, but it happened. This particular boy anyway walked, you know, up to Gdansk to try and work his passage to England and stole eggs in barns and like the things you see in films, right? And he was 13 years of age. Now, granted, a boy of 13 in the Jewish tradition in those days was regarded as a man.
But
they were only babies. But anyway, he got a working passage on a ship and he got to London and he had an address to get to in London. But I mean, didn't know London from, you know, any place. So when he got to London, the captain of the ship said, no, you haven't worked enough, and made him work back to Gdansk and then back to London again. But he did actually find whatever family members. And but that's a true story of somebody that's only two generations away from Harold, you know.
But the way you tell it, it's like even so emotional to even hear that story.
You can see it.
You never write about that kind of stuff, do you, Amy?
No,
not yet.
I don't know if I would. I don't know if I do it any justice.
But it's so incredible that it is within your family, those kind of stories.
Yeah.
But when you were growing up, you were very close, weren't you? I suppose she's your only daughter.
She's my only daughter. And we were very close. Just that we always got on. We didn't argue. Yeah. And I mean, and we, you know, Amy wasn't a sulky girl or anything. So I mean, we just always got on. I mean, the odd time, obviously. I mean, we weren't angels, but...
Did she ever have any terrible teen years?
I kind of say for about 3 months after she did her junior cert, but it was as much my fault as hers. I kind of just wanted her to be my little girl up in her bedroom studying for her junior cert, which she has always been a great student and was up in the room so long on her own that I bought her a goldfish for company.
So
she arrived at the door with this fish
because
named Jim Murphy.
Poor creature is up there hour after hour, but she was a great worker. But anyway, I wanted her to stay that way, and she wanted more freedom. And there was a couple of months that summer that, you know,
Do you remember we got over it.
Yeah,
but genuinely, it was as much my fault as hers.
It was telling half truths. It was just, you know, that time in your life where things get interesting socially.
Yeah. Other than goldfish.
Exactly. Sorry, I was over the goldfish by the end of that summer. Well, we lived for about 7 years.
He did. He lasted a long.
What was his name?
Jim Murphy.
The goldfish. Jim Murphy.
Yeah.
You gave him a full.
I gave him
surname.
Full name.
Why not Jim Huberman?
No, he was a Murphy. He didn't look like a Huberman.
No Jewish blood.
No, exactly.
But it brings us to the next piece of music, which reminds you of happy times with your mum. But she doesn't know what you've chosen, actually.
No, happy times. Mum doesn't know I've chosen this one, and she'll probably go bright red. But this makes her look, well, doesn't make you look kind of uncool. But it was one of the first concerts I ever went to that no one else would go with mum. That's also quite telling.
I really duped her. I said, would you like to go to a rock concert? And she said, oh, yes. She goes, right.
And I remember seeing my geography teacher there and I was so embarrassed. And she was a nun and I was embarrassed. But anyway, it does remind me of you fancied him for years as well, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, I think I know who you mean. I'll tell a story afterwards. Okay. Who is this person?
It's none other than Cliff Richard.
It's your rock concert.
My rock concert. I was lied to.
Tell me the story before we play the piece of music.
Before we play the piece of music, my mother God love her, the only way she could keep things going was to have a boarding house, right? So I shared a bedroom with my mother before I went away to boarding school. And my mother had a photograph of the Sacred Heart behind her bed.
Okay.
And on the wall beside my bed was a poster of Cliff Richard staring at the Sacred Heart.
That's so lovely.
That's so
she
sweet.
Still has the poster up.
Oh. I do not.
Which song have you chosen, Amy, from this rock star?
Living Doll. So you can get up and start.
Okay, let's listen.
Dancing
then.
Around the studio.
Got myself a crying, talking, sleeping, walking, living doll. Got to do my best to please her just cause she's a living doll. Got a roving eye and that is why she satisfies my soul. Got the one and only walking, talking, living doll.
Cliff Richard with Living Doll. Your favourite song, Amy.
Yeah, well, it is my favourite song. I have to get my mother down off the table now. She's been dancing for the last 5 minutes.
You've just recently published your second novel, I Wished For You.
Yeah.
What do you like more, writing or acting?
There's such different processes and you have to get into such a different mind frame for each. I mean, you know, acting is kind of, it's all encompassing. You're in a big crew on a big set and it's kind of 90 miles an hour. Whereas, you know, the writing is a very solitary thing, but it's something I really enjoy because I'm the master of my own universe and I entertain myself quite easily doing it.
Are you disciplined about it? Like,
yes, in so far as I can be, because I don't have a lifestyle that's very routined. But you're disciplined, you know, it takes me a while to actually get in the zone. I faff around on the internet for an hour or I kind of organise my notes while actually not doing anything towards writing. But my goal was always write 1,000 words a day when I'm in the flow of it. And some days I can fly out, other days I'm actually doing word count every fifth word. So, but when needs must, I don't procrastinate too much.
The two books, the first was Hello Heartbreak and this one is I Wished For You. Did you read them before they went?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not, because I didn't want in any way to influence. It's terribly, I mean, sometimes it can be a raised eyebrow, sometimes it can be a half smile.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to say anything. Sometimes I said, no, I didn't want it. It was totally her baby and I was delighted to be just handed the book the same as everybody else and read it.
And you dedicated the first one to your parents, didn't the second one to Brian?
Yeah.
But you're actually a great comic actress as well. I mean, you're really hilarious on Twitter too. Like, you're a witty person.
Thanks, Miriam. I enjoy that style of writing. I enjoy that kind of genre of acting as well. And, you know, doing comedy stuff, you kind of have to have a bravery with it as well, because you can't sit in the fence with it. You kind of have to make a little bit of a fool of yourself. So, you know, you can't be too self-conscious, I think. I think you have to trust yourself.
Allow yourself to
funny. Allow it, yeah.
When you read her books, I mean, they're mostly funny, but do you laugh or cry or do you...
Oh, I absolutely laugh. I mean, I roar laughing. In fact, when I was reading your second one, you were over one night for a sleepover. Brian must have been away or something. And our bedrooms were kind of beside each other with the two doors open and I was in hysterics at one particular part, which I won't talk about in case somebody hasn't read it. And she said, what are you reading about now, Mum? And I said, such and such. And it was just so funny. You know, when in the middle of the night or late at night, you're tired and we both started giggling. It was just, and my husband then shouts, Mum, in the name of God, what's going on upstairs? You know, I said, I'm reading Amy's book. No, I don't cry because I'm very proud of her and I don't think that crying is necessary.
Yeah.
And I didn't even cry at the wedding.
Did you not?
No, I did not cry at the wedding and I was amazed. I was just so happy. Yeah. It was one of the most wonderful days of my life as well as hers. When I got into bed at 4:45, probably from total overtiredness, I bawled, right? I bawled for probably an hour. But on the day, I couldn't have been happier.
Aww.
And I certainly, I didn't cry. No, your dad did.
Yeah,
Harold was very emotional, but and I was amazed because I'd cry at a film at somebody getting married, but I was just too happy.
Would you cry when the baby's born?
I don't know yet, but I probably
let
will.
Me know.
Yeah, I think we all will.
I probably will. Yeah, no, there's nothing like a birth.
Do you let Brian read your book before?
No, do you know, no. I don't let anybody read. I don't really look for validation. I really enjoy the sense of completion. And sometimes when I do that, I kind of nearly let it go. I don't know why that is. I think I'm just ready for the next thing then. Interestingly, he wants to read the next one I do, whenever that is. He's like, I'd love to read it in the early stages because he thinks it's a girly book, essentially. So it is interesting for a man to read it. But there's certain things he was saying to me. He's like, I would have loved to have read where you were going with that in the first place. And maybe I would have had a different opinion about it. So I don't know if that's good or bad.
Good. Sounds like he's going to give tips.
He's taking an interest in it.
So he's writing his book. So are you giving him any tips?
Well, I always slag him that he's not doing the hours behind on the laptop. It's like, you're writing a book is very different to me writing a book. But he is putting a lot. I mean, there's a lot of hours going into it. But, I mean, they're very different. His is biographical.
It'll fly off the shelf.
Well, I would Paul say to him, I could have written it, but then every page would just be like, my wife is just amazing. I couldn't do this without her. So he didn't let me.
Do you find it as a family, because Amy's now well known and obviously Brian's very well known, that can be difficult sometimes? Because I suppose if you're a public person, the rest of your family's actually private. They're private people.
I think celebrity can be a bit of a burden, to be honest. Not with your close friends, it doesn't matter. You know, not with people that you've known all your life, but with peripheral people it can be. And not that people mean to be any way awkward or anything about it, but I think celebrity is a bit of a burden, to be honest. I think it's lovely to be someplace where nobody knows you.
Yeah, definitely. Mm.
And I can see it if I'm, you know, shopping with Amy or something. I mean, she's being looked at continually, you know, and that's great in one way, but it's lovely when you're someplace like Dubai and nobody knows you at all and you can do what you like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Listen, it goes with the territory and it's, you know.
I mean, there's good and bad to everything. And most people, moreover, are really positive and really lovely.
Oh, absolutely.
But, and you know, it's like you said, the days where you don't want to face anyone and then you kind of have to put on the face and do the, thanks, you know, and have the chit-chat. But
there was this story about the day that I had the girl in the kitchen. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Talk about being naive, right? We never followed rugby. We never read anything other than the Irish Times. So I really wasn't that terribly aware about how famous Brian was. Do you understand me?
Yeah.
So I'm making this huge big pot of bolognese sauce to make a lasagna for my son's birthday, for his pals coming around before they go into town for a drink. And there's this knock on the door and this girl, does Amy Huberman live here? And I said, she does. And come in a minute, love, type of a situation, right? So she's in the middle of the kitchen and I'm sorry a minute, I'm here, you know, stirring the pot, and I realise she's from a newspaper. I mean, how naive is that? But it was just, Amy had finished a film the previous day. I often had people coming from RTE with scripts. There's the pink script, the blue script, the yellow script and everything, because they're always rewriting series. You know what I mean? That's the way they do with it. It's not like a film where a script is done and sealed and delivered. And that's what I assumed it was, or something to do with. And the next thing I realised, this girl was from a newspaper. So I had to usher her out as pleasantly as I could. And I said, you know, I have nothing to say. I said, I know you have a job to do and I feel sorry for you, but I have nothing to say. I'm not even going to say what question she asked me. But I closed the door and I thought, oh, my God, you know.
But those things just happen. I mean, it happened
to me. But I was just so naive about it. I had no idea, you know. Anyway.
Brian, a couple of years ago, this always makes me laugh. They were in camp before one of the Six Nations games, and they were out training and he came back and the receptionist said, oh, there's an urgent message for you. And he was, oh, okay. And whatever the name was, Mary Murphy rang at this time and she needs you to call her back. And he was like, I don't recognise that name. I'll ring her back. So I went up to his room and put the phone on private number just to, you know, because he didn't know, he couldn't think who she was. He was like, something to do with the union. I can't think. So anyway, he rang her back. This is only about 2 years ago. And she was like, Brian, love, thank you so much for ringing me back. I just wanted to wish you all the best tomorrow. It was just some random lady from down the country who wanted to wish him the best luck in the game.
That's so
sweet. Lovely. So he had a 5-minute chat with her and he was like, I possibly didn't need to make that call.
But it was actually really nice he did.
And I'd say no one would probably believe her as well down at the, you know, in the local kind of, you know, the golf club that morning. Mm. Do you know, I rang Brian and he rang me back and said, thank you for the good luck wish. But that's the thing. You kind of just have to, you know, to roll with it. And how are you to know all those things?
Surely. Now, if you have a boy, is he going to be playing rugby from about the age of 1 month?
No. God almighty. I feel it's... I feel sorry for the poor little fellow if it is a boy, the pressure on that. But no, I think both of us will just let whoever they are do whatever it is they want to do.
A bit like your own mother did.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And you still sing, don't you, in the church choir?
Yeah, in the church choir in Fox Rock. And I love it. We sing every Sunday morning. But I absolutely adore church music particularly. It's just so soothing. It's a type of meditation almost. Not necessarily the very modern stuff, the stuff that's coming out of America wouldn't necessarily be my cup of tea. But certainly the masses by Mozart and Gounod and things like that, they're just absolutely, and it's a privilege to get a chance to sing them.
And when you talk to people actually who sing in choirs and church choirs, it's amazing how much it means to them.
Totally, totally. They say, in fact, it's extremely good for your mental and physical health to actually sing on a choir, because you're expressing yourself artistically, but also there's everybody has to work together, and I absolutely adore it. As long as the voice remains, I'll be over in Fox Rock Church on a Sunday morning.
And we were going to ask her to sing, but you're not going to sing for me.
No, I'm not going to sing for you. I haven't got my piano.
What is the song we would have asked her to sing, because then we could just play that song?
Well, I think it's the one you've chosen, and it's Mum is kind of renowned for this one, you know, in our parts. Anytime I hear it, it always reminds me of her, and I always feel a little teary.
Tell them first of all which song it is.
Well, it's O Holy Night, which of course to me is the most glorious carol there is, and it's just beautiful. It's beautiful. It's I mean, I'd say it's probably on the radio every day now because it's Christmas week, but it's a beautiful carol.
Yeah, it's a beautiful carol. Well, look, your book, of course, Amy, which is I Wished For You, is in all bookshops now.
Yeah.
Best of luck to you both, yourself and Brian. Sandra, thank you so much also for being my guest
pleasure.
Today. My thanks on sound to Sheen and Eve Wheel, to my producer, Eileen Heron. We've actually chosen the beautifully voiced Emma Quinn to sing O Holy Night. And we're going to go out listening to that now. Thank you all very much for listening. We'll be here at the same time next Sunday.
The stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Saviour's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error born, till He appeared and the soul felt its worth.
That was Emma Quinn singing O Holy Night, and I wish you all a very peaceful Christmas.
Miriam Meets on RTE Radio 1. Listen back or podcast at rte.ie/radioplayer.